Greetings and revelacious mentations, my dichotomous listeners, and welcome to this March 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this wiki-wacky science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. I don't know about you guys, but I am pretty sick of winter at this point. I certainly don't look forward to summer with its ravening temperatures, but I could use a bit of spring right now. Spring seems to be teasing us around here in the last couple of days. It will get up into the mid-50s and sunny, and then the next day we'll be in the teens, below freezing and snowy again. That cycle has to break at some point. At any rate, I will warm you all with some new tales of science. I will start with a story that listener Mark Zanfardino sent in to me. Mark takes great pride in finding interesting stories, and this is certainly right up there. The story was published a couple of months back in the journal Nature and comes out of Dr. Enzi Shen's lab of the National Institute of Biological Sciences in China. It concerns determining biological age in the worm C. elegans. The small roundworm, Xenorhabditis elegans, has been a model organism for animal development for the last 20 years or so. It makes a great model because they are tiny, but transparent so that you can see every bit of their active insides. And they actually have an exact number of cells that can be counted and tracked and traced in every part of their body. Try doing that with a human or even a mouse. It grows up in the exact same way every time from a single fertilized egg cell to 959 cells as an adult. And since, again, its body is transparent, it's allowed scientists to map its growth and study internal changes in great detail. Shen now claims that she can predict how old and the length of life of a C. elegans with a new process that examines the mitochondria, the so-called power plant of the cell. As I mentioned previously, oxygen, despite what we think of it, is not as wonderful a thing as we actually think. Oxygen can be quite destructive in several degradative forms, and if you don't have the enzymes to deal with those dangerous forms, then your DNA and proteins are going to be prone to be damaged. The dangerous form of oxygen, called oxygen radicals, will certainly interact with all sorts of biomolecules and damage them severely. A free radical is created when an atom has acquired unpaired electrons buzzing around the nucleus. Inside the mitochondria, there's constant formation of free radicals, sometimes called reactive oxygen species. Some scientists have suggested that these so-called radical high-energy forms of oxygen may account for the aging of organisms which live in our atmosphere. Basically, the longer you live, the more damage arises from exposure to those free radical oxygens. Shen thought that if she could measure the amount of oxidative stress in the worms, she could predict how long they would live. She had previously discovered how to detect and count short bursts of free radicals in cells. She added proteins that fluoresce during oxidative stress and detected levels of oxidative stress by measuring the flashes of light that were given off by the dyes. The more flashes, the more oxidative stress that the cell was under. That is, the larger the number of free radicals present. She observed individual worms over their entire 21-day lifespan. The worms were at the peak of their reproductive ability during the second and third day of their lives, which is tantamount to about the ages of 18 to 30 in humans. And soon after that, the worms started their steady decline toward old age, and by about the 15th day, most of them are considered elderly. About as elderly as most 15-year-olds think that a human is who's over the age of 30. Shen found two periods when oxidative stress increased in the worm over those 21 days. The first period occurred around the third day of life when the worms were laying their eggs. And the other occurred at about the 15th day when the worms were quote-unquote old. Shen's group thereafter compared those stress findings using other worms who were genetically engineered to have longer or shorter lifespans. And yes, they found that these short-living worms started oxidative stress before 15 days at about 9 days and much higher oxidative levels at an early age. And the longer-living worms had delayed high levels of oxygen radicals and lower levels at an early age of 3 days. Shen concluded that the oxidative stress levels of a worm during early life can determine how long they can live. Yeah, it seems pretty clear that Shen agrees with that hypothesis that the more oxidative damage there is, the quicker you will age. That same hypothesis assumes that the diseases of aging result due to the increasing inability of cells to repair damage caused by that oxidative stress. Of course, all of this assumes the opposite as well. Organisms that have long lives must lower their oxidative stress by producing more antioxidants. But it ain't necessarily so. First, even though humans make less antioxidative chemicals than rats, rabbits, hamsters, and mice, not reducing our radical load as much, humans still live much longer lives than any of those rodents. Second, organisms that are anaerobic, that is that they live without oxygen present at all, they don't live forever. They have lifespans just like everything else on Earth does. So Shen is doing some very cool work in worms, and she may be able to predict their lifespans based on their early oxidative stress, but it may not work for any other organism. Well, Shen is not the only one who has been working on lifespan research and the ability to predict its duration. Dr. Utpal Banerjee at UCLA, in January, published a paper in the journal Cell that looks at an entirely different physiological phenomenon and lifespan. Unlike humans, many animals use the sense of smell as a guide through life. They divide the world into good and bad based on smells. Olfaction distinguishes nutritional foods from toxic ones, helps identify appropriate mates, and allows the detection of predators. A lot of research has gone into elucidating how odors are detected and how they are met with the appropriate behavioral responses, processes that are still not entirely understood. However, getting back to the original point, there's now evidence that in addition to its roles in acutely sensing odor, olfaction is involved in the regulation of the general physiology of animals. Once again, in the roundworm C. elegans and the fruit fly, the olfactory system regulates lifespan, as animals that have compromised olfaction live longer than their smelling counterparts, apparently. This exciting discovery has left many scientists scratching their heads. I mean, they're asking themselves, how on earth could olfaction have such a dramatic effect on physiology? Well, Banerjee accidentally discovered that during blood cell development in fruit fly larvae, that when he interfered with a receptor for the neurotransmitter GABA, which is gamma-aminobutyric acid, within blood cell progenitors, that is, blood stem cells, most of them differentiated early into blood cells. That suggests that the nervous system is involved in the regulation of the generation of blood cells. To find out more about how this neurotransmitter regulates blood cell development, Banerjee and his group set out to pinpoint its exact source. He found a cluster of cells in the fruit fly brain that secrete GABA into the larval blood to be responsible, since blocking the production of neurotransmitter within these cells led to early differentiation of the stem cells into blood cells. That demonstrated that the fly nervous system is indeed directly involved in the process of blood development. But what could be the function of this regulation? In order to address that question, the team tried to find parts of the nervous system that induce the secretory cells to release GABA. They found that inhibition of the olfactory system prevents the release of neurotransmitter from the secretory cells. That inhibition leads to early differentiation of stem cells, which suggests that the detection of smells is required for the maintenance of the pre-differentiated state of the blood stem cells. Now that's all well and nice and lovely from an academic standpoint, but does it have any other worth than that? Well, I think it does. What makes this finding particularly interesting is that it provides a possible mechanism for how olfaction affects lifespan. In the absence of odors, or if the olfactory system is inhibited, the number of blood cells that is being generated is actually increased. As these blood cells are involved in many aspects of innate immunity for the animal, this increase in number could leave the organism better protected against microbial agents and help the animal live longer. It's unclear whether the development of higher animals is affected in this way, but clearly humans are so bad at olfactory tasks, that is, smelling, perhaps that would be one reason that we have increased lifespans. Perhaps we just hyperstimulate our immune system in an effort to better protect ourselves against the uncharacterized, nasty old world that's out there. Also, of course, there's absolutely no evidence for that, and it is completely pie-in-the-sky speculation on my part. The next story is an update on the amazing proteins that can be found in milk. You may remember last month I spoke about a couple of applications of isolated milk proteins, including for lowering blood sugar and as an anti-cancer agent. Well, I'm back with a new function found for those proteins. Apparently, not only does milk do a body good, but it works to protect your fabrics as well. Dr. Jenny Alonghi of Italy's Polytechnic Institute of Turin reported in the March issue of the journal Industrial and Engineering Chemistry Research that she has discovered a milk protein that is flame retardant. In her research, she dunked cotton, polyester, and a polyester-cotton blend into a liquid formula of powdered milk proteins called caseins, which, by the way, are the key to making cheese. She found that the phosphate-rich proteins extinguished fires set in the fabrics, slowing the spread of blazes by 40 to 70%. Alonghi says, quote, "Upon burning, caseins may release acids, such as phosphoric acid, that form a molecular firewall and keep the flames from fanning out. A casein-based flame retardant would be a safe alternative to current fireproofing chemicals, which can give off toxic fumes," unquote. The thing that you are not going to see very soon will be the milk fire extinguisher. I'm not sure whether she was joking or not, but Alonghi says, quote, "That may have a delayed debut while we work on a version that can be easily washed out of cloth and does not smell like a rancid dairy," unquote. Perhaps the winner of the Captain Obvious Award for this year will be the next story. Frankly, I wonder how they got federal funding. But here it is. Practicing piano makes you a better player. Well, there you go. I guess my music teacher back in fourth grade could have been given several $100,000 to determine the same thing. I have to admit, I am not being completely fair here, though. Let me explain. This work came out of the lab of Dr. Brian Mathias in the psych department of McGill University. It was published this month in the journal Cerebral Cortex. The work actually shows that instead of simply hearing a melody, learning to play a song makes people more familiar with it. This is evidence that the brain has an enhanced ability to learn by doing and not simply by being passive. That's another way of saying, practice, you ninny, if you want to play this piano concerto. Don't listen to that MP3. Anyway, Mathias asked 20 skilled pianists, some professional musicians, to learn 12 simple melodies by listening to them or playing them. In later tests, the pianists were better at spotting a single errant note in a recording of a piece that they had played than at spotting a wrong note in a piece they had only heard. Electrodes monitoring the pianist's brain activity revealed that hearing a wrong note in a previously played song activated parts of the brain that handle movement, as when the fingers strike the keys. Mathias says, quote, "Physically doing a task sears its memory into the brain in a special way," unquote. From a completely non-scientific standpoint, I can vouch for that statement, and I think sear is the perfect word. Once I've myself learned a piece of music well, my cerebellum remembers even if I don't do it consciously. My fingers remember. It's a very strange feeling, which I suspect most musicians have experienced, but that seems to be the case of it. One professional musician I heard from had an interesting opinion on Mathias's work. Basically, they said that just listening to a piece of music to learn it may actually be beneficial to performance and give a performance a personal touch. Quote, "Personally, I find playing music from hearing it opens up creativity because I remember things that weren't there. My wrong notes often throw in a diminished or an augmented chord where there wasn't one before," unquote. Yes, basically they're saying that making a mistake in exacting reproduction can be a good thing. Mathias states as his conclusion, quote, "Outcomes suggest that auditory-motor interactions contribute to memory benefits conferred by production experience and support a role of motor prediction mechanisms in the production effect," unquote. Okay, take that as you will. This next story is out of the potential horror movie file. And I swear, some of the worst genre films have started with this exact plot. Scientists have discovered an ancient giant virus in the permafrost of the Siberian Arctic. They say it is harmless to humans and animals. The discovery was made in the lab of Dr. Jean-Michel Clavary of Marseille University, France. It was published online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science on January 30th. Now, as a rule, viruses are small. In fact, they are so small that even though scientists have known viruses are distinct from bacteria since the late 1800s, viruses were not visualized until the invention of the electron microscope toward the middle of the 1900s. So any large viruses are always an amazing and a bit appalling kind of thing. It's a bit like seeing a 6-foot-high rabbit. It's just hard to believe it even exists. We have known about so-called megaviruses for over 10 years now, but Clavary still made the headlines with his discovery. Not because the virus turns people into flesh-eating zombies. He has made a record-breaking find. It's the largest megavirus ever found. The new virus was dug up from the permafrost in Siberia and was dubbed Pithovirus sibiricum. It measures 1.5 micrometers in length and half a micrometer in diameter. That is much bigger than the former record holders, the Pandora viruses, which are only about 1 micrometer long and about half a micrometer in diameter. A micrometer is a millionth of a meter. To put that size of the virus in perspective, an E. coli bacteria is about 1 micrometer in diameter by about 3 micrometers long. So the diameter of the pithovirus is a bit more than the E. coli, although only half its length. That means that it's so big that you can see it with a high-powered optical microscope. You don't need an electron microscope to see this virus. The pithovirus was identified as part of a survey of the viruses of the Siberian permafrost, and it was isolated from a sample that's more than 30,000 years old, according to the researchers. Nonetheless, when given access to an amoeba host in the lab, the virus infected the cell, raising concerns about the possible risk such giant viruses might pose if they're released from the thawing Arctic ground. I guess I'm not the only one worried about the zombies. Clavary says in response, quote, "The revival of such an ancestral amoeba-affecting virus suggests that the thawing of permafrost, either from global warming or industrial exploitation of circumpolar regions, might not be exempt from future threats to human or animal health," unquote. Was that supposed to make us feel better? Because glaciers and permafrosts are melting, we might get infected by some sort of horrible plague? He goes on to say, however, quote, "Only a small proportion of the viruses on Earth represent viruses that can infect mammals, and an even smaller proportion pose any risk to humans. Still, vigilance and continued testing will be necessary. The notion that a virus could be eradicated from the planet is plain wrong and gives us a false sense of security. At least a stock of vaccine should be kept just in case," unquote. Wait, what? Is he implying that we might uncover smallpox or bubonic plague that would reinfect humanity? Well, yeah, that and worse. Clavary goes on to say, quote, "We might be able to eradicate viruses from the surface of the planet, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a single particle of that virus still alive somewhere. If viable variants are still there, that is a good recipe for disaster. It may be there is a Neanderthal virus out there somewhere that might infect a human. We should prepare ourselves," unquote. Okay, Neanderthals? Seriously? Is it just me or does this French guy make Ralph Nader look like a Pollyanna? Wow, and I thought I was a pessimist. Seriously, though, changing world climate has made me worry about tropical diseases coming farther north as the temperatures rise up here in the temperate regions, especially insect-borne diseases. But I never in a million years considered that melting Arctic ice in the north would be a source for new diseases as well. I guess it takes a special kind of guy to come up with that one. Thanks, Doc, for adding to my worry load. The last story of the night involves the human ability to match up a face with a name. Some people are good at this. My wife remembers the name of every parent and child in not only my son's kindergarten class, but the second grade kids and mom's as well. I'm always impressed. Frankly, I am lucky most days that I remember my own name. My wife thinks I don't try to remember names, but frankly, is this something that you should try to do, or is it something that should come to you without any major effort on your part? It certainly doesn't look like my wife is making any effort. She just remembers. Well, perhaps my problem is that I have a mutation in a gene that was recently discovered by Dr. David Skuse's lab at University College of London. Skuse's work was just published February 14th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. When mice don't produce the hormone oxytocin, or its receptor, they lose the ability to recognize other familiar mice by their smell. Although humans use other means for identifying one another, researchers have hypothesized that oxytocin plays a role in human recognition as well. Skuse and company report links between a particular single nucleotide polymorphism in the oxytocin receptor, OXTR, and social recognition abilities in members of 198 families with a single autistic child. A single nucleotide polymorphism is an alteration in a single base of the coding sequence of a gene that is found in a population. It's a single base pair mutation that does not kill function in a gene or protein, but may alter the way the protein works in a subtle manner. Very often, these polymorphisms are signifiers that something is wrong or not quite standard in the phenotype of the individual. Skuse says, quote, "One feature of autism is that there is a disruption in some aspect of social cognition. We chose families who had members with autism because we know that across the whole group there is a wide range of variability in social cognitive dysfunction." The researchers tested members of these families for facial recognition memory, emotional discrimination, and gaze detection, and then they looked at these alterations in that receptor gene. None of the polymorphisms they found were linked to autism, but the group found one variant, which they called RS237887, that was strongly associated with facial recognition memory in the individuals with autism as well as their family members. Skuse said, quote, "To me, this is really cool because we have previously shown that mice with a complete deletion of this gene can't remember other mice. But mice don't use facial recognition. They use olfactory recognition. They tell each other apart by smell. And this suggests that oxytocin is affecting some kind of common process across man and mouse when it comes to social recognition, even though different sensory modalities are being used," unquote. Skuse argues that oxytocin is not just the so-called cuddle chemical responsible for the formation of monogamous bonds, but also a single molecule that makes social stimuli more salient both in mice and men. He says, quote, "We think oxytocin helps the brain pay more attention to the fine details in social situations. And what this study suggests is that the OXTR receptor is involved in a very fundamental smaller process of social recognition," unquote. Well, I guess I have to ask myself then, do I have problems with social recognition because I'm a geek, or am I a geek because I have problems with social recognition? I guess the world may never know. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Remember to coat yourself in milk in case of fire. Don't melt the permafrost. Practice so you can get to Carnegie Hall. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.